not feel in the least bit tired, and the sweat poured off her in streams. Meanwhile, in number 82, the apartment right below Latunsky's, the playwright Kvant's maid was drinking tea in the kitchen, thoroughly baffled by the various crashing, clanging, and running sounds coming from up above. When she raised her head toward the ceiling, she suddenly saw that before her very eyes its white color was changing to a kind of deathly blue. As she was staring at it, the stain kept getting bigger and bigger, and suddenly it was oozing drops of water. The maid sat transfixed for a minute or two, amazed at what was happening, until finally a veritable shower poured down from the ceiling and splashed onto the floor. At this point she jumped up, put a basin under the stream of water, which didn't help at all since the shower was spreading and had begun to pour down on the gas stove and the table with the dishes. Kvant's maid then shrieked and ran out of the apartment onto the stairs just as the doorbell started ringing in Latunsky's apartment. "Well, the ringing has started. It's time to get going," said Margarita. As she mounted her broom, she listened to a woman's voice shouting through the keyhole, "Open up, open up! Dusya, open the door! Isn't something overflowing in there? We're flooded down below!" Margarita rose a few feet in the air and took a swipe at the chandelier. Two bulbs broke, and glass splintered in every direction. The shouting outside the door had stopped, and tramping feet were heard on the stairs. Margarita floated through the window, and once outside, swung her hammer and gave the glass a light blow. It sobbed, and shards of glass cascaded down the marble facade. Margarita moved on to the next window. Down below, people were running along the sidewalk, and one of the two cars standing at the entrance to the building blew its horn and pulled away. After finishing with Latunsky's windows, Margarita floated on to the neighboring apartment. The blows fell more frequently, and crashing and tinkling sounds filled the street. The doorman ran out the first entrance, looked up, hesitated for a minute, evidently not yet sure what to do, stuck his whistle in his mouth, and started blowing it like crazy. Accompanied by the whistle, Margarita finished off the last window on the eighth floor with particular relish, then descended to the seventh floor and began smashing the windows there. Tired by his long period of idleness behind the glass doors of the entranceway, the doorman put his whole soul into blowing his whistle, following the beat of Margarita's hammer, as it were, as if he were playing an accompaniment. During the pauses, when Margarita was flying from one window to the next, he would take a breath, and with every blow of Margarita's hammer, he puffed out his cheeks and blew for all he was worth, blasting the night to high heaven. His efforts, combined with those of the infuriated Margarita, produced major results. The building went into a panic. Windows that were still intact were thrown open, and heads appeared for just a second. Windows that were already open were shut. In the lighted windows of the buildings across the street, dark silhouettes appeared, trying to figure out why the windows of the new Drumleet house were breaking for no apparent reason. Down on the street, people were running toward Drumleet house, and inside it, people were tramping up and down all the staircases without rhyme or reason. Kvant's maid kept yelling to the people on the stairs that Kvant's apartment was flooded, and she was soon joined by Hustov's maid from apartment number 80, the one right below Kvant's. The Hustovs had water streaming from the ceiling both in the kitchen and the toilet. Finally, a huge piece of plaster broke off the ceiling in Kvant's kitchen and smashed all the dirty dishes. A major downpour followed. Buckets full of water gushed down from the seeping, sagging squares of sodden plaster. Then screaming began on the stairs of the first entrance. As Margarita was flying past the next-to-last window on the fourth floor, she looked inside and saw a man putting on a gas mask in a state of panic. She tapped his window with her hammer and gave him a fright, and he disappeared from the room. And suddenly, the wild devastation came to an end. Margarita slipped down to the third floor and looked in the corner window, which was covered with a flimsy dark blind. The room was lit by a faint nightlight. Sitting in a small bed, with netting on the sides, was a little boy of about 4 who was listening fearfully to what was going on. There were no grown-ups in the room. They had apparently all fled from the apartment.
"Windows are breaking," said the boy, calling out, "Mama!"
No one responded, and then he said,
"Mama, I'm scared."
Margarita pushed the blind aside and flew into the room.
"I'm scared,"
the boy repeated, and started to tremble. "Now, now, don't be frightened, little one," said Margarita, trying to soften her criminal's voice, which had been made hoarse by the wind. "It's just some boys breaking windows."
"With slingshots?"
asked the boy, no longer trembling.
"Yes, yes, with slingshots," affirmed Margarita. "And now go back to sleep."
"It must be Sitnik," said the boy. "He's got a slingshot."
"That's right, it's him."
The boy glanced slyly sideways and queried,
"But where are you, Auntie?"
"I'm nowhere," Margarita replied. "You're having a dream."
"That's what I thought," said the boy.
"Just lie down," instructed Margarita, "and put your hand under your cheek, and you'll see me in your dream."
"Yes, yes,"
agreed the boy, and he lay down at once with his hand under his cheek.
"I'll tell you a fairy tale,"
said Margarita, and put her burning hand on top of the boy's close-cropped head.
"Once upon a time, there was a lady. She had no children, and no happiness either. And at first, she cried for a long time. But then, she became wicked."
Margarita fell silent and took her hand away. The boy was sleeping. Margarita lay the hammer down gently on the windowsill and flew out the window. There was a huge commotion outside the building. People were running up and down the glass-strewn sidewalk, shouting things. Policemen were already on the scene. Suddenly, a bell started clanging, and a red fire engine with a ladder rolled into the street from the Arbat. But what happened next no longer interested Margarita. Taking care not to get entangled in any wires, she grasped her broom more firmly, and in a flash she was high above the ill-fated building. The street below slanted off to the side and receded into the depths. Taking its place beneath her feet was a whole tangle of rooftops, crisscrossed by gleaming paths of light. Suddenly, the whole mass moved off to the side, and the chains of light blurred and blended. Margarita gave the broom another upward prod, and the mass of rooftops fell away, replaced by a lake of quivering electric lights. Suddenly, this lake rose up vertically and then appeared above Margarita's head, while the moon shone beneath her feet. Realizing that she had turned a somersault, she resumed her normal position, and when she turned to look, she saw that the lake was no longer there and that, in the distance behind her, there remained only a rosy glow on the horizon. A second later, and it too had vanished, and Margarita saw that she was alone with the moon, which was flying above her to her left. Margarita's hair continued to stand up like a haystack, and the moonlight whistled as it washed over her body. Judging by how two rows of widely spaced lights below had merged into two unbroken fiery lines, and by how rapidly they vanished behind her, Margarita surmised that she was traveling at monstrous speed and was amazed that she was not gasping for breath. After several seconds had passed, a new lake of electric light flared up in the inky blackness of the earth far below, and it surged up beneath the flying woman's feet, only then to turn into a spinning vortex and disappear into the earth. Seconds later, the same thing happened again.
"Cities! Cities!" shouted Margarita.
After that, she saw what looked like two or three dully gleaming swords displayed in open black cases and realized they must be rivers. As she flew along, Margarita looked up at the moon over to her left and marveled at how it seemed to be rushing back to Moscow like a madwoman, while at the same time staying strangely in place, so that its surface was clearly visible. There she could see a dark, mysterious shape, which looked something like a dragon or a humpbacked horse,
its sharp muzzle pointed back toward the city left behind. Margarita was now seized by the thought that there was no need for her to drive her broom at such a frenzied speed, that she was depriving herself of the opportunity to look at things properly and enjoy the flight to the fullest. Something told her that they would wait for her at her destination, and that there was no reason for her to be bored by such senseless speed and altitude. Margarita bent the bristle end of her broom downward, so that the tail end rose toward the rear, and after drastically reducing her speed, she headed down to the ground. This downward slide, as if on an airborne toboggan, gave Margarita an intense thrill. The earth rose up to meet her, and out of the formless, once black mass emerged the mysteries and charm of the earth during a moonlit night. The earth was moving toward her, and Margarita was already bathed in the scent of the greening forests. She was flying over the very mists of a dewy meadow, then over a pond. A chorus of frogs sang beneath Margarita, and from somewhere in the distance came the inexplicably heart-rending wail of a train. Soon Margarita glimpsed it. It was crawling along slowly like a caterpillar, throwing a shower of sparks up in the air. After overtaking it, Margarita passed over another watery mirror in which a second moon floated by beneath her feet. Descending even lower, she flew along with her feet nearly grazing the tops of enormous pines. Behind her, Margarita heard the harsh sound of something ripping the air. Gradually, this sound of something flying through the air like a missile was joined by a woman's laughter, audible for miles around. Margarita turned around and saw that she was being pursued by a complex black object. As it drew close, it became more clearly defined, and she could see it was a mounted rider. And finally, the object completely revealed itself. Slowing down and drawing up beside Margarita was Natasha. Completely naked, her tousled hair flying in the wind, she was flying astride a fat hog, who was clutching a briefcase in his front hooves and beating the air furiously with his back ones. A pince-nez, which had fallen off the hog's nose, gleamed off and on in the moonlight as it dangled from a string at the hog's side, and a hat kept falling over the hog's eyes. After taking a good look, Margarita realized that the hog was Nikolai Ivanovich, and then her laughter, blending with Natasha's, rang out over the forest. "Natashka!" came Margarita's piercing cry. "Did you use the cream?" "Darling!" shrieked Natasha, waking the slumbering pines. "My French queen! I smeared it on his bald head, too!"
"Princess!" wailed the hog, pathetically carrying his rider at a gallop.
"Darling, Margarita Nikolaevna!" shouted Natasha, galloping along beside her. "I confess I took the cream, but we want to live and fly, too. Forgive me, mistress, but I'm not going back, not for anything. Ah, it's good, Margarita Nikolaevna. He proposed to me," at which point Natasha began tweaking the hog, who was puffing with embarrassment, on the neck. "Proposed? What was it you called me, huh?" she shouted, leaning over his ear.
"Goddess," howled the hog, "I can't fly so fast. I could lose some important papers. Natalia Prokofievna, I protest."
"To the devil with your papers!" yelled Natasha with an impudent laugh.
"What are you saying, Natalia Prokofievna? Someone might hear us!" howled the hog in pleading tones.
Galloping alongside Margarita, Natasha laughingly related what had happened after Margarita flew away over the gates. Natasha confessed that, without touching any of the things Margarita had given her, she had thrown off all her clothes, rushed straight for the cream, and anointed herself with it. And the same thing happened to her that had happened to her mistress. While Natasha was admiring her magical beauty in front of the mirror and laughing with delight, the door opened, and in walked Nikolai Ivanovich. He was excited and was holding Margarita Nikolaevna's chemise, along with his hat and briefcase. Nikolai Ivanovich took one look at Natasha and was stupefied. Red as a lobster, he managed to regain his composure somewhat and announced that he felt it was his duty to pick up the chemise and return it in person.
"The things he said, the rascal!" said Natasha in squeals of laughter.
The things he said, the propositions he made, the money he promised. He said Klavdia Petrovna wouldn't find out. Well, am I lying? Yelled Natasha to the hog, who merely lowered his snout in embarrassment. When they started fooling around in the bedroom, Natasha smeared some cream on Nikolai Ivanovich, and then it was her turn to be struck dumb. The face of the respectable downstairs neighbor had squeezed into a pig's snout, and his arms and legs had acquired hooves. When he looked at himself in the mirror, Nikolai Ivanovich gave a wild and despairing wail, but it was too late. Seconds later, he was saddled and mounted, flying the devil knows where out of Moscow and sobbing with grief.
"I demand the return of my normal appearance," wheezed and grunted the hog in a frenzied, pleading sort of way. "I have no intention of flying to an illegal assemblage. Margarita Nikolaevna, it's your duty to get your maid off my back."
"Ah, so now I'm just a maid? A maid, huh?" cried Natasha, tweaking the hog's ear. "Didn't I used to be a goddess? What was it you called me?"
"Venus," whined the hog, flying over a roaring, rocky stream and brushing against a hazel grove with his hooves.
"Venus! Venus!" shouted Natasha triumphantly, with one hand on her hip and extending the other toward the moon. "Margarita, Queen, ask them to let me stay a witch. They'll do anything you ask. You have the power."
And Margarita replied,
"All right, I promise."
"Thanks," yelled Natasha, who suddenly shouted sharply and somehow dispiritedly,
"Giddy up, giddy up, faster, faster, let's get a move on."
She dug her heels into the hog's flanks, thinned out by the mad gallop, and he bolted ahead so furiously that the air ripped apart again. In an instant, Natasha was just a black speck in the distance, and then she disappeared completely, the noise of her flight melting away. Margarita flew slowly, as before, in a deserted and unfamiliar locale, over hills dotted with occasional boulders and isolated giant firs. As she flew, Margarita reflected on the fact that Moscow was probably far, far away. Her broom was no longer flying above the tall firs, but between their trunks, silvered on one side by the moonlight. Margarita's light shadow slithered over the ground in front of her. The moon was now at her back. Margarita could sense the proximity of water and guessed that she was near her destination. The fir trees parted, and Margarita floated quietly toward a chalky cliff. Just beyond it, down in the shadows, was a river. Patches of mist clung to the bushes at the bottom of the cliff, but the bank opposite was low and flat. There, under a solitary cluster of leafy trees, the light of a campfire flickered, and some moving figures could be seen. It seemed to Margarita that she heard a humming, cheerful music coming from there. Beyond it, as far as the eye could see, there were no signs of human life or habitation. Margarita leaped down off the cliff and descended quickly to the water. It looked tempting to her after her aerial sprint. Tossing her broom aside, she ran and threw herself headfirst into the water. Her light body pierced the water like an arrow and sent a column of water skywards to the moon. The water was as warm as in a bathhouse, and when she surfaced, Margarita basked in the pleasures of a solitary night swim in the river. There was no one in Margarita's immediate vicinity, but splashing and snorting were heard coming from behind some bushes not far away. Someone else was taking a swim, too. Margarita ran up on shore. Her body tingled after her swim. Feeling no fatigue whatsoever, she danced about joyfully on the wet grass. Suddenly she stopped and listened. The snorting sounds came closer, and a naked fat man with a black silk top hat perched on the back of his head came out from behind some broom bushes. The bather's feet were covered with mud, so it looked as if he were wearing black shoes. Judging by his panting breath and hiccups, he had had quite a bit to drink, a fact confirmed by the brandy fumes starting to rise from the river. The fat man saw Margarita and stared. Then he let out a joyous whoop.
"Well, what do we have here? Is it her I see? Claudine, it's really you, the merry widow. Are you here too?"
Here he came forward to say hello. Margarita stepped back and said with dignity, "Go to the devil's mother." "What do you mean, Claudine? Mind who you're talking to." And after a second's thought, she added a long, unprintable oath. All this had a sobering effect on the thoughtless fat man.
"Oh, my," he exclaimed softly with a shudder. "Please forgive me, radiant Queen Margot. I mistook you for someone else. The brandy's to blame, a curse upon it."
The fat man then got down on one knee, swept off his top hat, bowed, and started mumbling some nonsense, half in Russian, half in French, about his friend Gessard's bloody wedding in Paris, and about brandy, and about how crushed he was by his grievous mistake. "You should have put your trousers on, you son of a bitch," said Margarita, softening. The fat man broke out in a happy grin when he saw that Margarita wasn't angry, and he announced rapturously that his trouserless state was due simply to his having absent-mindedly left them on the banks of the Yenisei River, where he had been bathing before coming there, and that he would fly back there at once, seeing it was only a stone's throw away. Then, after commending himself to her good favor and protection, he began edging backwards until he slipped and fell on his back in the water. But even as he fell, he kept a smile of rapture and devotion on his whisker-framed face. Margarita summoned her broom with a piercing whistle, mounted it, and was carried over the river to the opposite shore. The shadow cast by the chalk cliff did not reach that far, and the riverbank was flooded in moonlight. As soon as Margarita touched down on the wet grass, the music under the willows grew louder, and the sparks from the campfire cascaded more merrily into the air. Under the willow branches, studded with soft, fluffy catkins visible in the moonlight, sat two rows of fat-faced frogs, their cheeks distended like rubber, playing a spirited march on wooden pipes. Glowing pieces of rotten wood hung on willow twigs in front of the musicians to illuminate their music, and the flickering light from the campfire played on the frogs' faces. The march was being played in Margarita's honor. She was given the most gala reception. Diaphanous mermaids stopped their round dance over the river and waved to Margarita with seaweed. Their moaning salutations carried out over the deserted greenest shore and could be heard from far away. Naked witches jumped out from behind the willows, formed a line, and began to bow and curtsy in courtly fashion. A goat-legged creature rushed up to Margarita and kissed her hand. Spreading silk on the grass, he inquired whether the queen had enjoyed her swim and suggested that she lie down and have a rest. And that's exactly what Margarita did. The creature brought her a goblet of champagne. She drank it, and her heart was suffused with warmth. When she inquired after Natasha, she was told that Natasha had already taken her swim and had flown on ahead to Moscow on her hog to announce that Margarita would be arriving soon and to help in the preparation of her attire. Margarita's brief sojourn under the willows was notable for one episode. A whistling sound cut through the air, and a black body, obviously way off target, crash-landed in the water. Seconds later, Margarita found herself face to face with the same side-whiskered fat man who had introduced himself so infelicitously on the opposite shore. Evidently, he had managed to dash back to the Yenisei, since he was now in full evening dress, albeit soaked from head to toe. Judging by his crash landing in the water, he had obviously had a second go at the brandy. But even this mishap had not wiped the smile off his face. And the amused Margarita, laughing, allowed him to kiss her hand. Then everyone began preparing to leave. The mermaids concluded their dance and melted into the moonlight. The goat-legged fellow respectfully inquired how Margarita had gotten to the river, and when he learned she had come on a broom, he said, "Oh, whatever for? That's so uncomfortable." In the blink of an eye, he devised a rather dubious-looking phone out of two twigs and demanded that a car be sent over on the spot. And, indeed, a minute later, there dropped on the island a dun-colored open car. Only sitting in the driver's seat instead of the routine chauffeur
was a black, long-beaked rook wearing an oilskin cap and long driving gloves. The small island was clearing out. The witches flew away and dissolved in the moonlight. The campfire burned out, and the coals became covered with gray ash. The man with side whiskers and the goat-legged fellow helped Margarita into the car, and she settled into the wide back seat. The car roared, gave a jump, and soared almost as high as the moon. The island vanished, the river vanished, and Margarita was carried off to Moscow.
This ends Disc 9. The Master and Margarita, Disc 10.
Chapter 22. By Candlelight. The steady hum of the car as it flew high above the earth soothed Margarita like a lullaby, and the moonlight warmed her pleasantly. Closing her eyes, she turned her face to the wind and thought with a certain sadness of the unknown riverbank she had left behind, which she felt she would never see again. After all that evening's marvels and enchantments, she had already guessed who they were taking her to visit, but that didn't frighten her. The hope that there she would succeed in regaining her happiness made her fearless. However, she had very little time in the car to dream of that happiness, due either to the rook's expertise or the car's superior quality. Soon after Margarita opened her eyes, she saw below her the shimmering lake of Moscow's lights rather than the darkness of the forest. The black bird chauffeur unscrewed the right front wheel while they were still in flight, and then landed the vehicle in an utterly deserted cemetery in the Dorogomilov district. After depositing the unquestioning Margarita and her broom next to one of the gravestones, the rook sent the car rolling straight into the ravine behind the cemetery. It fell with a crash and was destroyed. The rook gave a respectful salute, mounted the wheel, and flew off. A black cloak appeared at once from behind one of the monuments. A fang gleamed in the moonlight, and Margarita recognized Azazello. After motioning to her to get on her broom, he himself jumped astride a long rapier. The two of them soared aloft, and seconds later, unseen by anyone, they set down near 302B Sadovaya Street. As the two companions, carrying broom and rapier under their arms, passed through the gateway, Margarita noticed a man in a cap and high boots who was loitering there, probably waiting for someone. As light as Azazello's and Margarita's footsteps were, the solitary man heard them and twitched nervously, unable to figure out who was producing them. At entranceway number 6, they encountered a second man who looked amazingly like the first. And the same thing happened again. Footsteps, the man turned nervously and frowned. When the door opened and closed, he charged after the invisible intruders, scanned the entranceway, but failed to see anything, of course. A third man, who was an exact replica of the second, and therefore of the first as well, was standing guard on the third floor landing. He was smoking strong cigarettes, and Margarita coughed as she walked past him. The smoker jumped up from the bench on which he'd been sitting as if he had been jabbed by a needle, began looking nervously about, walked over to the banister, and looked down. By this time, Margarita and her escort had already reached the door of apartment number 50. They did not ring, as Azazello opened the door noiselessly with his key. The first thing that struck Margarita was the total darkness in which she found herself. It was as dark as a dungeon, and, afraid of stumbling, she instinctively grabbed hold of Azazello's cloak. But at that moment, a small lamp flickered up above in the distance and began drawing closer. As they were walking, Azazello took Margarita's broom from under her arm, and it disappeared in the darkness without making a sound. They then began ascending broad steps which Margarita started to think would go on forever. It amazed her that the front hall of an ordinary Moscow apartment could contain such an extraordinary and invisible but very palpable endless staircase. But their ascent did come to an end, and Margarita realized that she was on a landing. The light moved up close, and Margarita could see the illuminated face of the tall black man who was holding the lamp in his hand. Anyone who had had the misfortune of crossing his path in recent days would have recognized him at once, even in that feebly flickering light. It was Korovyov, alias Fagot. True, Korovyov's appearance was greatly changed. The flickering light was reflected not in the cracked pince-nez, which should have been thrown in the trash long ago, but in a monocle, which was admittedly also cracked. The wispy moustache on his insolent face was now curled and pomaded, and there was a simple explanation for Korovyov's apparent blackness. He was in evening dress. Only his chest was white. Magician, choir master, wizard, interpreter, or the devil knows what. In a word, Korovyov bowed, and gesturing to Margarita with a broad sweep of the lamp, he invited her to follow him. Azazello vanished. An amazingly bizarre evening, thought Margarita. I was ready for anything except this. Has their electricity gone out or what? But most amazing of all is the size of this place. How can all this be crammed into a Moscow apartment? It's simply not possible. However meager the light from Korovyov's lamp, Margarita nevertheless realized that she was in an absolutely immense room. What is more, a room with a colonnade, which was dark and at first glance endless. Korovyov stopped beside a small couch, placed his lamp on a little pedestal, gestured to Margarita to sit down, and situated himself beside her in a picturesque pose, leaning with his elbow on the pedestal. "Allow me to introduce myself," said Korovyov in a creaky voice. "I'm Korovyov. Are you surprised there's no light? We're economizing, is that what you thought? No, 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 not at all. And if I'm lying, then let the first executioner who comes by, say one of those who will shortly have the honor of kissing your knee, chop my head off on this very pedestal. It's simply that Monsieur doesn't like electric light, and we turn it on only at the last moment. And then, believe me, there'll be no shortage of light. It would probably be better if there were less, in fact." Margarita liked Korovyov, and his high-flown chatter had a calming effect on her. "No," replied Margarita, "what surprises me the most is where you found all this space." With a sweep of her arm, she indicated the immensity of the room. Korovyov smirked sweetly, so that the shadows stirred in the wrinkles around his nose. "The simplest thing of all," he replied. "Anyone familiar with the fifth dimension has no trouble whatsoever expanding his residence to whatever size he wishes. I might add, esteemed lady, to the devil knows what size. However," Korovyov rattled on, "I have known people who haven't the faintest conception of the fifth dimension, or of anything else for that matter, but who have still worked wonders when it came to expanding their residence. Take, for example, the city dweller I heard about who got a three-room apartment on Zemliani Embankment and then turned it into four rooms in a flash without recourse to the fifth dimension or to anything else that goes beyond human reason, namely by dividing one of the rooms in two with a partition. He then proceeded to exchange his one apartment for two separate apartments in different sections of Moscow, one with three rooms, the other with two. That, you'll agree, makes five rooms in all. Then he exchanged the three-room apartment for two separate two-room apartments, and thus, as you can see, became the possessor of six rooms, though it's true they were scattered all over Moscow. He put an ad in the paper and announced his desire to exchange six rooms in various parts of Moscow for one five-room apartment on the Zemliani Embankment, and was thus on the verge of executing his last and most brilliant move when something beyond his control put an end to his activities. It's possible that he still has a room somewhere, even now, but I dare say it's not in Moscow. Now there's an operator for you, and you were pleased to talk of the fifth dimension." Although it was Korovyov himself, and not Margarita who had brought up the subject of the fifth dimension, she laughed heartily when she heard his story about the apartment wizard. Korovyov continued. "But to business, Margarita Nikolaevna. You are a very intelligent woman, and have naturally already guessed who our host is." Margarita's heart skipped a beat, and she nodded. Well then," said Korovyov, "we abhor mystery and innuendo of any kind. Every year Monsieur gives one ball. It is called the Spring Ball of the Full Moon, or the Ball of 100 Kings. A huge crowd attends. Here Korovyov clutched his cheek as if a tooth had started to ache. But I hope you'll soon see that for yourself. And so, Monsieur is a bachelor, as you yourself, of course, understand, but he needs a hostess. Spreading his arms, Korovyov said, "You will agree that without a hostess..." Margarita listened to Korovyov, trying not to utter a word. She felt a chill beneath her heart. The hope of happiness was making her head spin. "According to tradition," Korovyov continued, "the hostess of the ball has, first of all, to be named Margarita, and second, she has to be a native of the place where the ball is held. And we, as you can see, are travelling and find ourselves at the present time in Moscow. We found 121 Margaritas in Moscow. And would you believe it?" Here Korovyov slapped himself on the thigh in despair. "Not one of them was suitable. And then, at long last, a stroke of luck." Korovyov gave an expressive grin, bowing from the waist, and again Margarita felt a chill in her heart. "To be brief," cried Korovyov, "as brief as can be, you won't refuse to assume this obligation, will you?"
"No, I won't," was Margarita's firm reply.
"We're finished," said Korovyov, and picking up the lamp, he added, "Please follow me."
They walked between the columns and finally made their way to another room, which, for some reason, smelled strongly of lemon, where rustling sounds were heard and where something brushed against Margarita's head. She shuddered.
"Don't be frightened," soothed Korovyov sweetly, taking Margarita by the arm. "It's only Behemoth showing off his ball tricks, nothing more. And in general, may I be so bold as to offer you some advice? Margarita Nikolaevna, never, ever be afraid of anything. That's unwise. The ball will be lavish. That I won't try to hide from you. We'll see some people who wielded vast power in their day. But truly, when one thinks how microscopically small their resources are compared with the resources of the one in whose retinue I have the honor to serve, then it becomes ridiculous and, I would even say, pathetic. And besides, you yourself are of royal blood."
"Royal blood?"
whispered Margarita fearfully, pressing against Korovyov.
"Ah, queen," cackled Korovyov playfully, "questions of blood are the most complicated in the world. And if you were to ask certain great grandmothers, especially those renowned for their meekness, some most astonishing secrets would be revealed, esteemed Margarita Nikolaevna. I would not be remiss if, in speaking about this subject, I were to draw an analogy to a capriciously shuffled deck of cards. There are things in which neither class distinctions nor national boundaries have any validity whatsoever. I'll give you a hint. A certain 16th-century French queen would have been astounded, one must suppose, if someone had told her that many, many years in the future I would be walking arm in arm through a ballroom in Moscow with her charming great-great-great-great-granddaughter. But we have arrived." At this point Korovyov blew out his lamp, and it disappeared from his hands, and Margarita saw a strip of light on the floor in front of her under a dark door. And Korovyov rapped gently on that door. Here Margarita became so excited that her teeth began to chatter and a shiver ran down her spine. The door opened. The room turned out to be quite small. Margarita could see a wide oak bed covered with dirty, wrinkled and crumpled sheets and pillows. In front of the bed stood an oak table with carved legs, on top of which was a candelabrum with sockets shaped like bird claws. Burning in the 7 gold claws were thick wax candles. There was also a large chessboard on the table with unusually skillfully crafted chessmen. A low stool stood on a small, threadbare carpet. On still another table there was a gold cup and a second candelabrum whose branches were fashioned like a snake's. The room smelled of sulphur and pitch. The shadows from the candelabra crisscrossed over the floor. Among those present, Margarita immediately recognized Azazello, who was now dressed in tails and standing by the head of the bed. Now that he was all dolled up, Azazello no longer resembled the ruffian in whose identity he had appeared to Margarita in Alexandrovsky Park, and he gave Margarita a particularly gallant bow. A naked witch, the same Hella who had so embarrassed the respectable bartender at the Variety, and alas, the same one who, to Rimsky's great good fortune, had been scared off by the rooster on the night of the famous performance, was sitting on the rug by the bed, stirring something in a pan that gave off sulphurous fumes. In addition to the others, there was a huge black cat who was sitting on a tall stool in front of the chess table, holding a knight in his right paw. Hella got up and bowed to Margarita. The cat did likewise after jumping off its stool. Clicking its right hind paw, it dropped the knight and crawled under the bed to retrieve it. Dying from terror, Margarita somehow managed to see all this in the deceptive shadows of the candlelight. Her gaze was drawn to the bed, on which sat the one whom poor Ivan at Patriarch's Ponds had recently tried to convince of the devil's non-existence. This non-existent being was, in fact, sitting on the bed. Two eyes bore into Margarita's face. The right eye had a gold spark deep in its center and could pierce anyone's soul to its depths. The left eye was vacant and black, like the narrow eye of a needle, like the entrance to a bottomless well of darkness and shadow. Volant's face was lopsided, the right corner of his mouth stretched downwards, and his high, balding forehead was etched with deep wrinkles which ran parallel to his sharp eyebrows. An eternal suntan seemed to have been burned into Volant's face. Volant lay sprawled on the bed, dressed only in a long nightshirt which was dirty and patched on the left shoulder. One naked leg was folded beneath him, and the other was stretched out on the stool. Hella was massaging the knee of this dark leg with a smoking salve. On Volant's bare, hairless chest, Margarita also noted a gold chain with a finely carved scarab of dark stone that had some kind of writing engraved on the back. Next to Volant on the bed, on a heavy base, stood a strange globe that seemed to be alive and was lit up on one side by a sun. The silence lasted for several seconds. "He's studying me," thought Margarita, making an effort to control the trembling in her legs. After smiling, which seemed to ignite the sparkle in his eye, Volant at last began to speak. "I welcome you, Queen, and beg you to excuse my at-home attire." Volant's voice was so low that on certain syllables it drawled out into a wheeze. He picked up a long sword that was lying on top of the bedclothes, bent down and poked it under the bed, saying, "Come out of there, the game is over, our guest has arrived."
"Not on my account,"
hissed Korovyov anxiously in Margarita's ear, playing the role of prompter. "Not on my account," began Margarita.
"Monsieur,"
Korovyov breathed into her ear. "Don't stop on my account, monsieur," said Margarita softly but clearly. After regaining control of herself and smiling, she added, "Please don't interrupt the game on my account. I imagine the chess magazines would pay a tidy sum for the chance to print it." Azazello cackled softly and approvingly, while Volant looked at Margarita attentively and then remarked as if to himself, "Yes, Korovyov's right. How capriciously the deck is shuffled. Blood tells." He extended his hand and beckoned Margarita to come closer. She did so without feeling the floor beneath her bare feet. Volant placed his hand, heavy as stone, yet at the same time hot as fire, on Margarita's shoulder, turned her towards him, and seated her on the bed next to him.
"Well, since you are so enchantingly kind,"
he said, "and I never expected otherwise. We'll dispense with formalities." Again he leaned over to the edge of the bed and shouted, "How long is this farce under the bed going to continue? Come out of there, accursed Gunts!" "I can't find the night," replied the cat in an affected and muffled voice from under the bed. "He galloped off somewhere and a frog's turned up instead." "What do you think this is, a fairground?" asked Volant, pretending to sound angry. "There was no frog under the bed. Save those cheap tricks for the variety. If you don't come out this minute, we'll consider that you forfeited the game, you damned quitter."
"Not at all, monsieur," howled the cat, and he crawled out that second, holding the knight in his paw.
"I'd like you to meet," began Volant, and then interrupted himself. "No, I can't stand the sight of this clowning fool. Look what he did to himself under the bed." In the meantime, the cat, covered in dust and standing on his hind paws, was bowing to Margarita. He had a white bow tie around his neck and a pair of ladies' mother-of-pearl opera glasses hanging from a cord on his chest. In addition, the cat's whiskers were gilded.
"Well, what's all this?" exclaimed Volant. "What did you gild your whiskers for, and why the devil do you need a tie if you're not wearing trousers?"
"Cats aren't supposed to wear trousers, monsieur," replied the cat with great dignity. "Will you tell me next that I have to wear boots? It's only in fairy tales that you see a cat in boots, monsieur. But have you ever seen anyone at a ball without a tie? It is not my intention to look ridiculous and risk getting kicked out. Everyone adorns himself as best he can. Keep in mind, monsieur, that this applies to my opera glasses as well."
"But whiskers?"
"I don't understand," retorted the cat dryly, "why Azazello and Korovyov could sprinkle themselves with white powder when shaving today, and why is that preferable to gold? All I did was powder my whiskers. It would be a different matter if I had shaved. A shaved cat, now, that really would be an abomination. I couldn't agree more. But I can see," here the cat's voice trembled with hurt feelings, "that I'm being picked on, and that I'm facing a serious dilemma. Should I even go to the ball? What do you say to that, monsieur?"
The cat was so puffed up with hurt feelings that it looked like he would burst in a second.
"Oh, what a rogue he is, what a rogue," said Volant, shaking his head. "And every time the game isn't going his way and he's about to lose, he starts putting up smoke screens, like the worst charlatan on the bridge. Sit down this minute and stop talking drivel."
"I'll sit down," said the cat, seating himself. "But I object to what you just said. My remarks are far from being drivel, as you so nicely put it in the lady's presence. Rather, they are a series of neatly packaged syllogisms which would win the respect and admiration of such connoisseurs of the genre as Sextus Empiricus, Marcianus Capella, or, who knows, even Aristotle himself."
"Checkmate," said Volant.
"Please, please let me see,"
rejoined the cat, starting to survey the board with his opera glasses.
"And so," said Volant, addressing himself to Margarita, "I present to you, Donna, my retinue. This fellow who likes to play the fool is the cat, Behemoth. You're already acquainted with Azazello and Korovyov, and this is my maid, Ella. She's quick and efficient, and there is no service which she cannot provide."
The beautiful Ella smiled and turned her green-hued eyes to Margarita while continuing to scoop out gobs of salve which she rubbed on Volant's knee.
"Well, that's that," concluded Volant with a grimace as Hella pressed his knee with particular force. "As you can see, it's a small, diverse, and ingenuous group."
He fell silent and began spinning the globe in front of him. It was so artfully constructed that the deep blue oceans on it moved, and its polar cap looked real, snowy and icy. Meanwhile, the chessboard was in chaos. An utterly distraught king in a white cape stamped on his square, his arms raised in despair.
Three white lansquenet pawns with halberds stared in confusion at a bishop who was waving his crozier and pointing ahead to where Volant's black knights could be seen on adjacent black and white squares, mounted on two mettlesome steeds who were pawing the squares with their hooves. Margarita was fascinated and astounded that the chess pieces were alive. The cat, lowering his opera glasses, quietly poked his king over in the back. The latter covered his face in despair.
"It doesn't look good, dear behemoth," said Kuravyov with quiet venom. "The situation is serious, but by no means hopeless," retorted Behemoth. "Moreover, I'm completely confident of ultimate victory. A careful analysis of the situation is all that is required." He began this careful analysis in rather a strange way, namely by making faces and winking at his king. "Nothing will help," observed Kuravyov. "Oh," shouted Behemoth, "the parrots have flown away, just as I predicted." And in fact, from the distance came the sound of many flapping wings. Kuravyov and Azazello rushed out.
"To hell with your bald, practical jokes," muttered Volant, without taking his eyes from his globe. As soon as Kuravyov and Azazello were gone, Behemoth's winking intensified. Finally, the White King caught on to what was expected of him. He abruptly pulled off his cape, threw it down on the square, and ran off the board. The bishop donned the king's cast-off attire and took the king's place. Kuravyov and Azazello returned.
"False alarm, as always," grumbled Azazello, looking askance at Behemoth. "I thought I heard something," replied the cat.
"Well, how long is this going to go on?" asked Volant. "Checkmate!"
"Perhaps I misheard you, my maître, but my king is not in check, nor could he be."
"I repeat, checkmate."
"Monsieur," responded the cat in a fake anxious voice, "you must be overtired. My king is not in check."
"Your king is on square G2, said Volant, without looking at the board.
"Monsieur, I'm horrified," wailed the cat, faking a look of horror. "There is no king on that square."
"What are you saying?" asked Volant in disbelief as he looked at the board and saw the bishop on the king's square turn away and cover his face with his hand.
"Oh, you scoundrel," said Volant pensively. "Monsieur, I must again appeal to logic," began the cat, pressing his paws to his chest. "If a player says checkmate and there is no trace of the king on the board, then the checkmate is null and void."
"Do you concede or not?" shouted Volant in a terrible voice.
"Let me think for a bit," answered the cat meekly.
He then put his elbows on the table, covered his ears with his paws, and began to think. He thought for a long time, and finally said,
"I concede." "Kill the stubborn beast," whispered Azazello. "Yes, I concede," said the cat, "but only because I can't play when I'm being badgered by envious bystanders."
He got up, and the chessmen clambered into the box.
"Hella," said Volant, "it's time." And she disappeared from the room. "My leg has flared up again, and now there's this ball," continued Volant.
"Allow me," said Margarita softly.
Volant stared at her intently, and then moved his knee over to her. The salve was as hot as lava, and burned Margarita's hands, but she did not flinch, and rubbed it into his knee, trying not to cause him any pain.
"My close friends insist that it's rheumatism," said Volant, keeping his eyes fixed on Margarita. "But I strongly suspect that the pain in my knee is a memento of my intimacy with a certain enchanting witch whom I met in the Brocken Mountains on the Devil's Pulpit in 1571.
"Oh, how can that be?" said Margarita.
"It's nothing. It'll pass in 300 years' time. A multitude of medications have been recommended to me, but I'm a traditionalist and remain partial to Granny's remedies. My grandmother,
The vile old hag left me some incredible herbs. Is there perhaps some sadness or anguish that is poisoning your soul?
No, monsieur, there's nothing like that, was Margarita's shrewd reply. And now that I'm here with you, I feel completely fine.
Blood is what counts, said Volant merrily, to no one in particular, and added, I see my globe interests you.
Oh, yes, I've never seen anything like it.
Yes, it is nice. To be frank, I don't like listening to the news on the radio. The announcers are usually young women who can't pronounce place names properly. And what's more, at least a third of them seem to have speech defects, as if that were a job requirement. My globe is much more convenient, especially since I have to know exactly what's going on. For instance, look here. Do you see that piece of land washed on one side by the ocean? Look how it's bursting into flame. A war has broken out there. If you look closer, you'll see it in detail.
Margarita bent toward the globe and saw that a square of earth had grown wider, had assumed vivid colors, and had turned into a kind of relief map. And then she saw a strip of river and next to it a village. A house the size of a pea got as big as a matchbox. Suddenly and noiselessly, the roof of the house blew off into the air with a puff of black smoke. The walls of the house caved in so that nothing was left of the two-story matchbox except piles of rubble spewing black smoke. When she looked even closer, Margarita could see a tiny female figure lying on the ground. And next to her was a baby, lying in a pool of blood, with its arms stretched out.
So that's that, said Volant, smiling. He had no time to sin. Abaddon's work is flawless.
I wouldn't want to be on the side fighting against this Abaddon, said Margarita. Whose side is he on?
The more I talk with you, Volant replied pleasantly, the more convinced I am that you're very intelligent. Let me put your mind at ease. He is totally neutral, and sympathizes equally with both contending sides. As a result, the outcome is always the same for both of them.
Abaddon, called Volant in a soft voice, and out of the wall appeared a thin figure in dark glasses. The glasses made such a strong impression on Margarita that she let out a soft scream and buried her face in Volant's leg.
Stop that, yelled Volant. How nervous people are nowadays.
He slapped Margarita's back so hard that her whole body reverberated with the sound.
Can't you see he's got his glasses on? Moreover, he never has appeared, nor will he ever appear, before anyone's time has come. And besides, I'm here. You're my guest. I just wanted to show him to you.
Abaddon stood, motionless. Do you think he could take off his glasses for just a second? Asked Margarita, pressing close to Volant and trembling, but only out of curiosity.
No, that is impossible, Volant replied in a grave voice, waving his arm at Abaddon, who then disappeared. What do you wish to say, Azazello?
Monsieur, answered Azazello, permit me to speak. Two outsiders have appeared, a beautiful woman who keeps whimpering and begs permission to stay with her mistress, and also her, pardon my expression, hog.
Beautiful women have strange ways, remarked Volant.
It's Natasha, Natasha, exclaimed Margarita.
Well, let her stay with her mistress, and send the hog to the cooks.
To be butchered? Cried Margarita in fright. Have mercy, monsieur. That's Nikolai Ivanovich, our downstairs neighbor. You see, there's been a mistake here. She rubbed him with that cream.
Just a minute, said Volant. Who the hell is going to butcher him, and what the devil for? Just let him sit with the cooks for a while, that's all. You'll agree I can't very well let him into the ballroom.
Well, yes, added Azazello, and announced, midnight is approaching, monsieur.
Ah, good. Volant turned to Margarita. And so, please come with me. I thank you in advance
Don't get flustered, and don't be afraid of anything. Drink nothing but water, or else you'll wilt, and it will be hard for you. Time to go.